Hi, good afternoon. Can you all hear me all right? Great. I'm Natalie Anderson. I teach in the Department of English Literature, and I found out about 5 minutes ago that I'll be introducing Tasha Lewis. I'm thrilled to have that privilege, actually, although I didn't teach Tasha during the time that she was a student here. I did come to know her during her years at the college. First, when she collaborated with a poet who I'd been doing a directed writing project with to create an artist book, which was also a poet's book, and then later, because I was so enthusiastic about that project, I took the trouble to see the other artwork that she was doing and was thrilled by it. Last summer, I guess it was, Tasha was in touch to say that she had some ideas about a project and was wondering if she might bounce some ideas off me that had to do with illustrating James Joyce's Ulysses. You probably know that there's a kind of artist book that's going on these days that takes a well-known literary text and does something with it. There's been a new presentation of Leaves of Grass where the words form images, the images of Walt Whitman doing things, or images of the particular things being described in the verse. There's also a really amazing book that's an illustrated version of Moby Dick. Again, not a one-to-one correspondence. It's more taking ideas from the pages and doing something unusual with them, something unexpectedly artistic with them. But Tasha decided that she would like to do this sort of project with James Joyce's Ulysses. Of course, one of the seminal texts, I'll just say, I mean that word in every sense, seminal texts of the 20th century, a text which is famously enormous, and lots of people who are knowledgeable about the world of literature will tell you in a whisper that they haven't actually finished it yet. I myself did finish it when I was in my 40s, when I was going to be in Dublin on Bloomsday, the day in which the events occur that are in Ulysses. It was well worthwhile to finish it with that goal in mind. And since then, I've been able to participate in the Rosenbach Museum downtown that has a celebration of Bloomsday of that day and involves lots of people from the city reading portions of the book. And so it was a particular delight for me with that year-by-year reminder of the riches of Ulysses to see the various ways in which Tasha explored this project. She's going to tell you about the particulars of it, but I just wanted to say it has been a thrill to watch this come into being. You can see it yourself online, and I hope that there will be a book available before too long. Tasha is amazing, and here she is.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Nat. There are three copies circulating of the project. Just feel free to multitask, look at the slides, look at the book. I think that it has kind of an enormous scope, as the text does. So I think it helps for you guys to sort of actually be able to handle it and feel the scale of what I did, because I'm only going to be showing a tiny fraction of really what I ended up with. So this is a portrait of James Joyce by Robert Motherwell, and he is sort of the reason why I'm here. I really don't think that I would have done this for a different literary text. I mean, I was an English major. I love a lot of books. There are a lot of books that I would reread over and over again, but there's something about the depth of this text, that there's so much to mine out of it that really primed it for this experience that I sort of put it through and put myself through. And really the idea did come to me on a subway ride in New York City. And I wasn't reading the text at the time. I really have no idea how it came to be, but I just was thinking about it, and I was like, if you were to illustrate it, you would have to illustrate, one, I didn't think it was gonna be me, I was just like, one would illustrate a different style for every chapter, because Joyce is really working in totally different ways, thematically, tonally, literally in the words that he's using, the physicality of the text, everything is different depending on the chapter. So I knew that I wanted to create these image pairings that would change and the styles would change. And so I had this idea and I wrote it down in my notebook, and it wasn't until a year later that there was a proposal for a print residency, and I thought, okay, this is a print idea. I'm a sculptor in my regular artist life. And so this was kind of an idea I had bouncing around, and so I wrote this proposal, and as many of you know or will find out writing proposals, you often don't get the thing that you had to be so enthusiastic about. But I found out a few weeks later that I was going to get 8 weeks of time in northern Maine in order to pursue this rather specific project. And that sort of, you know, pushed me off a cliff. I had to make it a real thing. And so I started looking back at a lot of secondary criticism, reading the text again, trying to flesh out what each of these 18, because they had to be 18 different styles for the 18 different chapters, what they were going to be. And, you know, I'd done a lot of readings for Phil's seminar class, the professor who used to teach modernism. And so he directed me in some ways, but I also found this critic, Karen Lawrence, and her book, The Odyssey of Style in Ulysses. And I was really drawn to a lot of books that, instead of creating a large sort of thematic breakdown analysis of the book, there are a current of literary critics who just do a chapter on each chapter. And I loved the way that she broke down how she sees what Joyce is doing in the text, which is to break from the paternity that normal authors, even modernist authors, really have. You know that Wolf is writing Wolf. It's just, you can tell that it's her. And Joyce in Ulysses is really breaking from that mold. He begins with a style that is very similar, and in fact exactly the same as Portrait of an Artist, but he breaks from that, and then you get a new person and a new writer, and it's like each chapter is this new person, this new author. And so I love that idea because I wanted to do that with my artistic style. I didn't want it to be obvious that it was me making every chapter. I wanted to break away from that. So I love the way that she really shaped that idea of paternity and breaking from it in these various masks. And another thing I did, because it seemed very prudent, was to look at the history of illustrators of Ulysses. And there have been many, and many famous ones, indeed. Henri Matisse, you can see that this is an illustration for Circe. And it's, you know, rather notorious because most people don't actually think that Matisse read the text before he illustrated it, and a lot of people think he was just illustrating the Odyssey. I read another article that was sort of a counterpoint, that Joyce actually knew that and had a phone conversation with him and said, that's fine. But there's a whole to-do about, you know, the authenticity of the illustration. But fundamentally, these guys, Matisse, and we'll see with Motherwell, are not interested in serving the text as I wanted to serve the text. They're interested in serving their own artistic style. It's very easy to draw the parallels, and of course I picked his paintings that fit it, but you know, between you recognize the authorial mark of that artist. And so, you know, I was looking at these authors, these male painters interpreting this text, and you know, I knew I wanted to do something totally different. And I also knew I wanted to change the scale. So Motherwell created these 22 etchings, and he was a scholar of the text. He definitely, unlike Matisse, he definitely spent time with it. It really shaped the way he thought about a lot of things. But for him, the biggest connection to the text was the color of these slides. And for me, if you're gonna, you know, if this art is supposed to respond to the text, if color is the only cue that you're giving your viewers, like, you're not gonna be able to get that much real information out of it. You know, maybe some of these chapters are about flesh, or maybe some of them are about nature, and that's why the color changed. But really having one image per chapter is like such a burden to put on each image. I mean, these are two images by Richard Hamilton, another illustrator, one for Sirens, the other for Circe. And, you know, he went to great pains. Hamilton really was a major scholar. He really, in the Circe element, he went through all of the moments in Circe where Bloom changes costume. And if any of you are familiar with Circe, it's rather a nightmare. And he really went to a lot of effort to try to make it reflect the text. But again, in my eyes, both of these images are very clearly painted by the same hand, that there's no break in style. And so that's really what I was striving towards in my work. Ironically, I also did another one of these that was a mono style, as I'll call it, in 2011. And I think potentially this kind of needed to happen. It kind of was a precursor to this much bigger project. So I created 18 images with knots, and then I scanned the knots and created cyanotype prints. and on they were each paired with a laser-cut version of Joyce's schemata, which is sort of a text I'm about to show you guys. But it explains each chapter and kind of breaks down into the smallest pieces, the hour, the setting, the color, the symbol. So this was a piece I did, as I said, in 2011, and you know, maybe it did found what I was gonna do, but most specifically it's because of the schemata. And any of you guys who are English majors and Joyce readers have probably been given this handout. Joyce wrote this sort of list of information to kind of guide people, because at the very beginning he didn't want to give anything away, but everybody was like, dude, Joyce, we don't know what's going on. Can you please, you know, give us at least something to go on? Like, what are the Greek names mean? What, you know? So he created this this piece of, you know, this text, and I think it's fascinating. I love that there are breaks. I love that, you know, the specific images that he uses, the specific words, the colors, all of this is, you know, to me was very generative. So this was kind of the starting point for my project. I'm going to start at the beginning, but I'm not going to do every chapter because there are 18 and I could go on for hours and we don't have that much time. But Telemachus, if you saw here, the colors are white and gold and the art is theology. And so Telemachus, that begins the book, Stephen has woken up in a tower and his friend or roommate, Buck Mulligan, is shaving, and he's sort of going through the sacrilegious sermon movements as he's shaving. And throughout the chapter, Stephen is sort of the protagonist, and we're following him. He has these moments of lapse where he kind of, he fogs into these this remembrance of his mother and her death and her deathbed. And so there's this fogginess happening. And also a sort of crescendo of the chapter is the delivery of milk, because they're getting breakfast and Buck is really mad because they don't have any milk. And so the milkmaid and the milk arrival is this sort of symbolic moment in the chapter. And so in thinking about translating this visually, I was like, okay, I wanted something that could be milky, that could be foggy, that I could translate this kind of this tactile feeling of you know, memory that Stephen is experiencing. And so I use these Xerox transfers. And essentially a Xerox transfer, you print it, and then you glue the transfer onto another substrate paper. And then after it's dried, you can wipe away, sort of peel away the pulp, revealing a reversed version of the image. So in that way, the pulpiness was able to be this fog, again, sort of obfuscating some of the images in the background. And the gold leaf, which again is sort of cueing off of what Joyce said, allows it to kind of break out of that. It's a very hard, solid, shiny, like drawing, you know, it's drawing a lot of attention, sort of like Buck is, away from Stephen, who is this sort of melancholic thinker. So, you know, that's just, that was sort of how I put together this first chapter. Oxen of the Sun is another one that I was drawing pretty strongly from the schemata. He's describing the technique as development, this embryonic development. And the chapter itself is written beginning in sort of middle to old English and then going through various rhetorical styles, and then it kind of ends with like Cockney accents. And so there is the development of language, but the actual narrative is in a lying-in hospital, and this woman is giving birth, and she's been in labor for 3 days, and there are all these men that are sort of hanging out and carousing, waiting for the birth to happen. And so the content, really, of this chapter is development, relationships, women, birth, childhood, all these things. And so I knew I wanted to, you know, pull a lot of collage material from those kind of realms, from medical journals, from various art history things, from ads. But as you can see in the title page, I also wanted to reflect that embryonic development. And I did that by using an encaustic base. Essentially, encaustic is usually beeswax and a resin, but I just decided to use just the beeswax on its own. So it sort of creates this depth that I can layer in, and again, a kind of obfuscation of those deeper layers of text that are sort of hidden in between the layers of wax that build up. And another thing that I didn't really expect would happen with the wax is it also made the images, the collage materials, sort of translucent. So I was able to get this interesting overlap that I, you know, didn't get in some of the other chapters where I'm using sort of a standard collage. Wandering Rocks was shaped again by Karen Lawrence, going back to one of her theories. And she described the chapter and the way it's narrated, because it's not omniscient. You're going around Dublin. There are, it's, I think, 32 different vignettes. And it's sort of this omniscient eye, but it's a mechanical eye. So she writes it, she describes it as this like writing machine. And I loved the idea of a writing machine kind of absorbing information, traveling around Dublin. And I was like, okay, what is the counterpart to that in the real world? And I thought, oh, it's Google Street View, because there are all these Google Street View trucks driving through and they're absorbing everything indiscriminately. I don't know if you guys have ever found really weird things on Google Street View, but I decided to walk around Dublin in Google Street View. And for the most part, there have been a lot of scholars who have sort of mapped out exactly where everybody is in Wandering Rocks at exactly what time. And so you can really see, like, they're on this street, and then they turn on this street, and then... So I followed, as best I could, those things. So each page is illustrated with an image drawn from Google Street View. And because, you know, it wasn't going to be a one-to-one, I wasn't going to get a great image of the same doorway that's being described in Joyce, I was really looking for those moments of sort of strangeness. Like, I love down here, it says poets and novelists. It's like this alleyway that has all this trash and debris. And another another page, I like, they caught like a woman with her purse, and she's all, you know, blurred out. But all these like moments that are very Joycean moments captured again by this Google Street View. So my personal practice did come a little bit into play. I was talking all this about distancing myself from my artistic style, but the chapter Nausicaa, I kind of drew back in. It was probably inevitable, but my sculptural work is essentially based in photographic fabric prints that are hand-sewn around sculptures. And so I do a lot of embroidery and a lot of hand-stitching. And so Nausicaa, which is, it's a very female chapter, it's about this young teenage girl who is very obsessed with the way she looks and the way people perceive her and all the cosmetics that she can use. And so I knew I wanted to pair that with ads. And so I found all of these sort of historic ads and was able to use those as kind of the base for these illustrations that were done in thread. Again, a traditional sort of female occupation that probably Gertie would be doing. And for me, was a very familiar occupation because of my other work. Scylla and Charybdis, for me, is probably the hardest chapter in Joyce to read. I think because it's a chapter about literature, it's even harder to read. And so they're discussing Hamlet. It's not a very visual chapter. Almost every other chapter has so many rich, beautiful scenes and allusions, and Scylla and Charybdis, it's just a bunch of guys sitting in a library. So I wasn't really going to be able to pull out the same images that I can in, you know, somewhere they're moving across the city. So to me, I was interested in the idea, because Stephen puts forth a coded interpretation of Hamlet. And so I wanted to create my own visual code that would kind of play off what Stephen is, he's trying to put forth this rather ridiculous theory. And so I was inspired by my friend Shanti Grumbine, who does these amazing cutouts of newspapers. And so she'll actually cut out, excise all of the words of like the New York Times and then present it as this kind of mosaic, like a broken mosaic. And so what I did is I redacted all of the text except for the first few lines of that page. So the words aren't together, they're spread out. And there's no way to indicate a space, so you don't really know when one word ends and when the next word begins. And if you don't have the text next to you, it just looks kind of like this mosaic with all these redactions. And I think that was interesting to me. You know, it was one of the only chapters that has text in it that you can read. Almost all the other text has been redacted either with thread or with other means. And so I found that people who interact with this chapter who are less visual, who are more literary, they're interested, they want to figure out the code. And so that kind of worked as a totally different style for me to implement for this chapter that I feel, you know, isn't very visual. So for most of the work that you've seen so far, I've been doing a lot of collage. And in order to do collage, you have to get great sources. And so I did do this entire project in 8 weeks, but before that, the 6 months before that, I was preparing this kind of library of sources. And the following chapters really rely heavily on those source material that I put together. A lot of them, I found a lot of visual dictionaries. So there's lots of, you know, images, mostly a lot of ad cuts from sort of a publisher called Dover. They reprint all these old ad cuts, you know, anatomy books, art books, anything that I could feel, you know, I could get for cheap enough that I could then cut up. So one of the key chapters where, you know, the source is really important is Cyclops. And I think of all the chapters, this is the one that I understood so much more after I went through this process. I think when I was reading it for class, it kind of got reduced into this sort of a xenophobic, anti-Semitic guy, and Bloom, poor Bloom, stuck in this bar having to deal with him. And I think when I reread it, I realized that there's a really interesting tension between this kind of absolutist person and all of the like very like mythic, beautiful ideas he has about the myth of Ireland. And so I knew that I wanted this chapter to be tied in with Ireland itself. So I got this amazing encyclopedia called the Cyclopedia of Ireland, and it was actually printed in 1904, and it had all these amazing county maps, and then it also had this heraldry. And the heraldry provided me with this symbolic, abstract, geometric elements that I could then pair with the actual maps, which I then, as you can see on the side, I cut out and kind of created these metaphors of the body, this like vein, this like system, and again, kind of redacting parts of the image. So it was really the contrast between those two elements that allowed me to pull out a lot of images in that text. And again, in that chapter, I really thought it was going to be abstract. I didn't think that I was going to be able to play to the narrative, because when I had read it in class, I didn't really understand what the narrative was. And so somehow it moved the way that I thought about the text forward a lot. Hades is another one of my favorite chapters, actually. And the source material for that, when I thought about death, I thought about sort of 15th century woodcuts as being kind of this beautiful kind of celebration of death. The image here is from a book called La Danse Macabre, and it's showing that it's also from the 1450s, I think, showcasing that every level in society, everybody gets taken away by death, and so it's all these various people and all these skeletons. And so I thought that would be a great place to start, and then I built upon that with some other books of Albrecht Dürer, because he also has an amazing woodcut portfolio to draw from. And again, I was able to kind of create these scenes in this page. The carriage has just driven by Stephen, but nobody knows, you know, Bloom doesn't know that, and he's kind of this lost son. And so that was like, you know, to me, I look at that and I see that part of the narrative. And to you guys, you might just be interested in the way that I combine the images, you know. So there's this kind of double layer in the way that what I see and what you guys see, and then, you know, what other readers of Joyce would see. I don't know if anybody remembers the line when Bloom is thinking they're at the graveside and he's imagining that you would have a record player playing the voice of the dead person next to the grave, because that would be a way for you to remember them, remember the sound of their voice. And I just love that image of, you know, so many processes that Bloom is going through are just so fascinating. So it was great for me to kind of put, you know, paint to paper, as it were, and make them real. Ithaca was probably the biggest endeavor of collage that I did. It's, I think, almost 80-some pages. And for that, I kind of, you know, the previous two chapters were a little bit smaller, around 40 pages. So this one, I kind of opened up my scope and basically used any, you know, any paper material that I could find. And again, because I was opening that so wide, and I was getting a lot of, you know, newspaper articles, magazine things, I needed a way to kind of redact the text again. So I turned to stitching. And so to me, the stitch is kind of, it's in a foreign element here because it's in paper. And Ithaca is the penultimate chapter where Bloom and Stephen come to Bloom's house, and they're kind of going back and forth, and one of them, you know, Stephen has this artistic sensibility and Bloom has more of a scientific sensibility, and they're both kind of ill at ease. And so I kind of like the idea of bringing the stitching into the paper, because it's also sort of ill at ease in this paper world. But I also love the way that, you know, you kind of have to punch through the paper before you can sew it, and there's something kind of great about that. Here's another image, sort of a double portrait of Bloom and Stephen. The one on of the urination is probably one of my favorite sections of Ithaca that describes their simultaneous urinations. It's really great. I think Ithaca is one of my favorite chapters in the book. But again, the thread was able to enhance the what I couldn't find in, you know, a magazine. I was able to bring in with thread and sort of modify the images or add a little bit, add geometry or redact or do what I needed to do in order to really sharpen it to the point that Joyce is getting to in that page. So these are images of Eastport, Maine, where I did all of this work. And you might be wondering how I did any work at all, because it's really gorgeous. But I actually drew a lot from my location, because I was here doing a residency, you know, site-specific. I was in a print shop. And it really did affect the way that I approached a bunch of the chapters. So I'm going to talk about three chapters that were really influenced by that. So that one of the first image of those, I actually did one of the watercolors for Proteus of this marsh grass in this tidal marsh. And you can see another one sort of in situ watercoloring. And Proteus is the third chapter. And so Stephen is, you know, walking along the beach. He's having these kind of amorphous thoughts about life. And, you know, all of these feelings and sensations he's describing are actually very similar to me walking along the beach in Eastport. You know, it's the same water. And I thought that was kind of a great starting point for a chapter that, you know, it's not very long. There are only 12 images that I watercolored, but it was a great way for me to, like, kind of tip my hat at Eastport and include these images that also reference back to what Joyce is describing. And for the final chapter, Penelope, I did a collaborative project with the community, but instead of watercoloring on site, I actually was taking Polaroid images. And Penelope, there are a few reasons that I wanted to do Polaroids. There's something about the aura of a Polaroid. It has a very specific, beautiful, you don't have to filter it kind of filter, but it has something to do with memory. For me, it just, you know, it just seems so fitting for, you know, this chapter without any punctuation. That's just this recall of, you know, her whole life, these memories all free associated together. And so I went around the community and, you know, the fish that you see here, Molly's describing her, a memory she has of being in Spain and being at a fish market. And so I got the local fishmonger to give me some bait fish and I like photographed that. And that bicycle is my bicycle. The bed here that, you know, she's describing the disheveled nature of her bed, that's my bed, you know. So there were these like parallels that I was able to pull together that, you know, really locked the project into the place that I did it. And the final element was, of course, that I was at this print shop and I was surrounded by type and I was spending all this time making these collages. And I finally went over and pulled up one of the type drawers and saw that they had all this gorgeous wood type. And so for the Aeolus chapter, which is set in a newspaper office, I knew that I had to do something with this type. And so I used it. I mostly pulled out the headlines that are already pulled out in the text and sort of placed them in the background. And then to create the image, I actually used a date stamp. And I created these sort of masks in order to get these various gradients and crisp lines on the image. But, you know, it was trial and error trying to set type. I don't know if anyone has set type before, but you have to think about it in the other direction. And I'm a little bit dyslexic, so that was kind of fun. But really, being in that place, I wouldn't have produced the work the way that I did if I hadn't had access to this type. So it was like a really important, you know, connection that I was, again, able to make to Eastport and to that print shop. Here are some more of those. And the date stamp, of course, is the date that I was working on it. So I think it's October 20th and 21st that I was working on these pieces. So time, that's a big issue, right? I did this in 8 weeks. And I'll talk a little bit about the pacing for that. But also, if you've seen a copy of the book, you might have noticed that there are clocks that appear kind of at random, totally separate from whatever the style is. They're all the same, these pronto plates, which is a kind of lithographic plate of the same clock, which is the clock in my dining room. And again, going back to that schemata where Joyce is very clear about, you know, the timing of each chapter, I knew that I wanted time to jump out. And I wanted that to break whatever visual, you know, if you were engrossed in something, I wanted the time of 4 o'clock to jump out at you. And that was just kind of a decision I made about the way that I wanted the book to be broken up as a kind of pace. And I also think that, you know, it orients the reader. Like, if you're actually reading my book next to, you know, Joyce's Ulysses, you might not know that, you know, this page is taking place at 2:30. But if you look at my clock, you're like, oh, this page is happening at 2:30. This is great to know. So it's kind of like a way for me to impart kind of some essential piece of information. And about the pacing, you can see this image. It has all of my very fast renderings for the Lotus Eaters. And essentially, I paced myself that I had to make 12 pages a day. And that was just like a math thing. And I think what really helped finish the project and keep the pace that high was that I could jump between these various styles that I showed you and many others. And so if I was bored with, you know, setting type, or if I was bored with watercoloring, I could switch and do something totally different. And the biggest question mark I had was Circe. And I had some ideas going in, again, sort of pulling off of what Karen Lawrence describes as the second half of the novel is pilfering a lot of the styles from the first part of the novel. I was like, okay, great. I can use that for Circe, and in Circe, I'll pull sort of the same style from Hades, I'll pull some of the same style from Proteus, and I'll rethink it and rework it for Circe. But then I realized that with 150 pages and with a rather insane, again, if any of you are familiar with the novel, a rather insane plot, things that happen, there was no way that I was going to be able to find all of the collage elements, or that I was going to be able to print or, you know, typeset all of these things. So I knew I had to change my initial thought. And I was pretty uncomfortable with it because, I mean, it's an uncomfortable chapter. So it was like, that kind of felt right. So I ended up working in a process called a silkscreen monoprint. And that's what you see here. This is like my first batch that I was like texting people. I was like, can I do this? Does this look horrible? And I did end up pursuing it, and I felt a little bit better about it. But it was kind of nice to feel uneasy because, it's a very uneasy chapter. It's a very gritty chapter. And so the way that the silkscreen monoprint works is you can actually just draw directly onto the silkscreen with anything water-soluble. So I was using chalk pastels, Contact crayons, just water-soluble markers, pencils. And the chalk pastel kind of gets pulled into this matte medium that you then squeegee across the drawing. And so you can sort of see in various places this like grittiness. And here's an example of two very different pulls. So on this one, I used a gel medium that was completely clean. I wanted it to be bright. When I was here, I wrote a lot of papers about the soap. Again, I don't know if any of you have read the book, but I got really excited about the soap in Ulysses. So this is one portrait of the soap that Bloom buys. And so that's with a very clean, I wanted it to be clean and bright. I wanted to kind of pop out of some of the other murkier pages. And the other one, after I pulled with the monoprint, I would actually get gel that had pulled up some of the pigment. So for example, the soap one was very orange and green, but others were, you know, if I used any black at all, it would just turn gray. And so I started printing with that gray material, so the background for some of the Circe images would be very gritty and very dark. So this is where Patty Dingham comes back from the dead and is talking to Bloom. And so I knew that for that page, I wanted it to be grittier. Here's another sort of suite of a few of them. Again, you can see, you know, I was able to start harnessing that grittiness, which at first was very distracting and difficult for me to deal with. Like, as an artist, I was fighting against it, but I soon realized that if I just kind of let it lead me, that it was really going to be the right way to approach Circe. A pretty unapproachable thing. So this is a picture of the full project. At the end of it, the physical artifact of the piece is in these 8 binders. But that's not really how I saw the end product. The end product is the book that's, I think, still circulating. And so I was able to, you know, I scanned all the images and I created this book. You can self-publish books. It's kind of amazing. And so this is what I have. And I'm at this point sort of trying to figure out in which direction I'm going to take it. You know, is it an artist book that can be read completely separate from Ulysses but has this added depth if you know the text or want to be interested in the text? Or is it sort of an aid to reading Ulysses? Is it a kind of twin to the Gabler edition that you can read together and that will expand your reading experience. I mean, it certainly, I learned so much about the text doing this project, and I hoped to kind of convey some of that knowledge in the drawings, but of course, you won't see exactly what I was trying to make you see. And so there's always going to be that gap. But that's kind of what I'm grappling with now. And I'm super excited to take any questions people have about that or about my butterfly piece, which we are also celebrating tonight.